Let's talk digital.
We are at the cutting edge of digital tweaks, changes, transformation.
A local digital marketing podcast.
Conversing with industry experts and getting excerpts about the exceptional.
Hosted by Audrey Naidu.
Sit back, relax, enjoy your podcast. I'm really looking forward to what's coming up in South Africa in the next couple of months and years. Hey everyone, welcome back to Let's Talk Digital with me, Audrey Naidu. Happy New Year, everybody. Hope you guys had a good December break and ready to tackle the new year. In an old Indian parable, several blind men get to touch an elephant. Each man feels a different part of the animal. Afterwards, they each describe the elephant, but their accounts vary depending on what they touch, the tusk, tail, or perhaps a leg. They get confused and angry with each other because of the discrepancies in their description, but eventually learn that the elephant is a large animal with many parts. All their stories are true. Each just forms one piece of the whole. This parable speaks to our topic today, which is the data revolution and applying a single customer view of customers. As we transition into a new era of data management, data privacy and consent, we need a next level data strategy to connect the sum of all the moving parts. My guest today is Calvin Yonk, CEO of Yonk Digital. Calvin started as a computer engineer experimenting with VR and AI. He moved into the digital marketing arena 15 years ago. An absolute pleasure to be speaking to Calvin today. Welcome to the podcast, Calvin. Calvin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Audrey. It's great to join you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I noticed that during lockdown, you picked up a new hobby. You want to tell us more about that?
My running, yeah.
Yes.
It's been great. I used to joke that I used to be an amateur jogger and laughed at people who took this sport seriously. And then when lockdown came and I couldn't stay healthy anymore, I picked up running just as a way to stay fit. And the bug has bit. I now look out for actual races and got desires for ultramarathon running. So yeah, it's going to be interesting, I hope.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing. I think you can add that to your bucket list.
Absolutely. I did one marathon recently, which was a bucket list item. So tick.
I guess we all have some of that. So having looked at your LinkedIn profile, you have a track record of being involved in startups throughout your career. And having started Yonk Digital in 2014, give us some insights on your entrepreneurial journey to date.
Sure. So Yonk was actually the first company that I had the privilege of starting. I actually came out of the corporate space. I was at Cell C for a number of years, running their digital team. And then I guess realized there was an opportunity to bring in some cool tech that I had fallen in love with when I was there, and decided to start this company where I would introduce it to peers in my industry, and very fortunate enough to be able to build that into a company that's still running after 8 years. And since then, I've also had the fortune of being involved in a number of other ventures as well. We've got a called Mirror Mirror that I have been part of, and Airbuy, which is a payment company, and a number of other startups where I get to help mentor and invest.
Yeah, so it's a wonder where you have time for running, hey?
Early mornings.
Okay, yeah, that's the best time to do what you love. So I understand from our conversation, you've been up to London recently to attend a conference on the very topic up for discussion today. And we are talking about the first party data revolution, you know, which is quite an important and trending topic. And it's certainly an important one for business to take note of. What, in your opinion, is propelling the shift?
I think we've come to a pivotal point in how companies and, you know, even individuals think about data. You know, we've gone through so many loops and, you know, high points and low points in terms of how personal data is used, that there's a bit of a reckoning at the moment, I think, which is forcing everybody to ask the question, is my personal data mine or somebody else's, or am I the product or am I not? And I think that the consumer is winning, which is great. And that means that all the technology companies and publishers and everybody in that game has to rethink how consumer data is used. And I think that is where we're at right now. Is for the last 10, 15 years, it's been a bit of a free-for-all in a number of ways. Maybe the Wild West, as everybody works out what they can and can't do. And now regulation, or perhaps some personal interests or company interests from various providers, is guiding us into this space of potentially looking at first-party customer data way more importantly than we would, the third-party data that we used to get with third-party cookies and DMPs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of drivers which we are going to touch on soon enough in terms of what's causing this shift. But, you've been exposed to global markets. Where are we in terms of progress in South Africa relative to other markets?
I think it depends who you ask. South Africans or even African companies in general always feel like they are way behind. And while I don't think we're necessarily leading the trend, we definitely aren't 5 years behind on things. It's a matter of potentially waiting for technologies and processes to be proven in other markets before we're able to invest, because potentially there's less budgets. But everybody understands what's needed. It's really just have they been able to build momentum internally to get those projects off the ground. So I would say that COVID has propelled that incredibly. Everyone's been forced to rethink that, the whole digital transformation movement includes how they think about their customers' data as well. So I would say that we are not that far behind in terms of intention, possibly a good 6 months to a year behind in terms of implementation.
So I would sum it up as we all on a global data maturity journey.
Yeah, I think so. And people know what that journey should look like. It's really just about breaking through some of those barriers and silos and maybe historical legacy issues to achieve that as a company.
So just, let's just talk about what are some of the benefits associated with brands having a SCV strategy?
The single view of the customer is, it just makes sense, even from a historical perspective. We've maybe been spoilt in the past having this ability to go and target audiences without even knowing who they are, or speak to people or personalize ads to people without them being part of our family or our community. So the benefits of moving to this view of understanding our customers across the board means that we can include them in our family, include them in our plans and our futures, and be able to give them what they need as they go through that journey. It might not be as broad from an acquisition perspective, but from a retention and an upsell and a cross-sell perspective and a customer experience perspective, if you take this seriously and you put effort behind it, knowing what they're saying, knowing what they're doing, knowing what their preferences are as a company as opposed to a division, just ensures that you're not wasting money and efforts, duplicating efforts or you know, wasting money on communicating with people who don't need that kind of communication. So there's a lot of efficiencies by creating this single view and then building company-wide strategies off of that.
Definitely. But in reality, easier said than done, because it comes with its own challenges of getting this right. So I know yesterday when we chatted, I really liked what you said about know your customer journey. It's understanding that the customer journey is non-linear. We have to consider the messy middle. How would you approach this customer journey orchestration?
So I think that there's a couple of steps, I guess, and one of the important steps is to impart value on, first of all, collection of data across any number of different data sources, divisions, channels, even journeys that people are going through. Finding a way of identifying these individuals, whether they're anonymous at first or eventually become known, and then being able to attribute future, knowledge about them to that persona. And then imparting a lot of value on things like consent. I think consent is going to be incredibly important going forward, vital if not, and creating that as part of your strategy. So that would probably be step one, is imparting actual value as a company on those major things and creating a almost like a value exchange to have the customer want to share this kind of information with you. You should be able to build a strategy where the customer feels like if they give you the kind of information that you're asking for in the right ways, that they're going to get some kind of value out of that. I think the other step would definitely be to re-strategize your targeting mix. So if you are targeting both prospects and existing clients, moving more towards a contextual targeting rather than putting a lot of effort on audience targeting and retargeting, that's probably where most of the value will come. And then also as a company, I think making first party data a differentiator. How do you become that standout company that knows how to treat their customers well because of the strategy you've taken to understand them better? So almost make it known that this is part of the handshake. If they're going to join your family, you will give them either better service, better products, or some kind of value that other competitors aren't doing because of this strategy. So it really comes from the top. It's not a division that gets it done. It's not just CX that gets it done. It's not even just marketing that gets it done. It has to be built into the DNA almost.
Mm.
And then once that's done, is to have this value exchange across the whole customer journey, not just at the start. It's not about just getting them to log in somewhere and hopefully that gives you enough information to treat them as an individual. It's every part of the journey and taking all those various scenarios we spoke about very seriously as potential points to ask for something more, to gather just a little bit extra to enrich those profiles. And make the customer want to. And then obviously there's this whole concept of journey orchestration, which means that this is a constantly evolving discipline. It's not something that you build at the beginning of the year and see how it pans out a year later. It's a day job.
Yeah, so I know you also mentioned that how do we identify the metric of work or metric of value? And there were four things you mentioned, because I said to you that, this value exchange becomes a transactional exchange, both parties win, but the power then shifts into the consumer's hands.
Mm. Very, very true. So, you've almost got to treat every consent mechanism as an ad, and as important as an ad. So the same kind of effort that we've always put into advertising, banner ads and efficiencies and testing, you need to be, putting that same kind of effort into that mechanism that brings consent or the addition of additional information. And I think that every step of that journey of, let me give you a little bit of information about myself, or let me give you consent to retarget me, or something along those lines, has value. There's a value that'll be attributed to that, because that conversation of how consumers are potentially going to be able to sell their own data or have be remunerated for their own data in the future should be treated as real and perhaps current. Maybe we don't pay actual money for it, but they should get something for it. And the idea of gamification comes to mind, I think, where we've almost perfected gamification through social media and games and all this kind of stuff, but using it in the customer journey, we know that people will do things for you. They'll either work for you, or they will free as a customer, or they will engage in some way for essentially four different things. And I always summarize it as SAPS, SAPS. Status being number one. Will they be given some kind of higher status within your organization as a consumer? Maybe there's a loyalty program. Maybe there's a community that they're part of where they are recognized. Maybe they get special privileges because of the status that they have achieved. The second one would be access. Do they get access perhaps to special content, special products, special services, events, something along those lines that other people don't get access to? The third one is power. And if people feel like they are being given power to change, maybe they are included in the product ideation stages, or they are given the ability to, maybe head up a forum or something like that, they will then work for that. And then the last one, the last S in that SAPS is staff. You know, it's the least, the one that's least effective in the long term, according to the theorists. So staff, you know, money, vouchers, swag, all those kind of things, that will get people to the party, but it won't get them to stay. And we want to have this as a long-term strategy. So yes, staff does form part of that that strategy, but it's a very small part of that value exchange. So the goal is that people should be thinking of that transactional value as potentially being more ethereal than, I will give you 10% discount on this product if you give me your information.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's quite an interesting perspective, because a lot of brands have been giving away stuff in exchange for data. And what you're saying requires a new way of thinking and an approach, and maybe looking at creative solutions of how do you remain authentic as a brand. The customer feels like valued at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Stuff will work for certain customers, but again, I think it'll only work in the short term, and the decision needs to be made, I guess, on a case by case basis. Is this a once off activity or journey that we want people to go on, or is this something that we want to have for a number of years and potentially have some kind of a strategy around keeping them involved and engaged more than just that one sort of exchange.
Yeah, let's now talk about some of the sources of data in context of fast and slow data. Can you maybe give us a view of, you know, how you would define fast and slow data?
Yeah, it's interesting. Fast data are, because we've been a number of years been working in things like social analytics, we've often spoken about the volumetric side of social data, which would be engagement rates and, you know, click through rates and fan page growth and that kind of stuff, versus what are people saying, which is the almost like the qualitative side of it, which holds its own value. And fast data are always considered to be similar to volumetrics or real time analytics. What's the churn rate? What's the sign-up rate? What's the, you know, current basket size of people coming through our site? Whereas slow data is the collection of data over time to give us deeper insights, in my view. You know, things like proven hypotheses, or the ability to create an audience segment over time. You know, that's not going to happen in an hour, but given enough data points and enough individuals sharing information about their activities and their needs and desires, you're able to start creating segments over a longer period of time. Or what we've been speaking about, this single view of customer is slow data. It's a process. It's not something that we can quickly look at a dashboard and immediately start making changes of. We need to kind of build on it. So that's essentially how I see it. But the actual metrics underneath those are vast, I would say, depending on which discipline you're in.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to what you're saying, in terms of slow data, it's also looking at historical data because, you know, every brand has access to their first-party data. And what you're essentially doing is integrating your structured and unstructured data now in one place so that you get a holistic view of your customer. But I was at a PwC session yesterday talking about the very same topic in terms of brands building the first body data strategy and some tips and advice for brands. And what they say is almost 90% of experience data is unstructured data. An example of this is social media comments, engagements with a brand, etc. So bringing in the emotional data into structured data and layering that data, and having worked with social media data yourself for such a long time, how can brands harness the value of unstructured data?
Yeah, so back in the day when Crimson Hexagon was still a brand, they had a tagline of quantifying the qualitative, which I always found really, you know, really nice way of thinking about it. Because unstructured data, the way people speak, and that's social data, but it's also customer service, you know, support data, it's survey data, it's NPS, you know, surveys, all that kind of stuff, where people are giving us their unstructured opinions or desires or needs, should be quantified first. And there's enough technology out there to go and take this large set of discussion of unstructured text, and then to quantify that into things like topic analysis, emotion analysis, sentiment, obviously, which everyone knows about, but then also classifying that kind of conversation into what we at UNO call pillars of value. You know, so being able to analyze those that unstructured text to decipher what are people saying about my particular products or channels or services or values even, and then being able to assign that back to our own internal analytics that we're getting. So there is a layer between, you know, so if we had to talk actual technology, you know, the single view of customer probably culminates in something like a CDP. But before it gets into that CDP, there are other layers of technology such as, you know, strong social intelligence tools that will take that kind of data, transform it into something that is quantifiable, and then assign that back into almost like normalize that to be able to be used in your single view of customer stuff. The other side to that, apart from social, is, you know, there's a large trend at the moment to unify the voice of the customer. And that is, as I mentioned, taking social data, taking customer service data, taking survey data, bringing that all into one space, using powerful AI to analyze that. And then irrespective of where that conversation is coming from, be able to say that, well, in this part of the country, people with this kind of product generally don't like your stores, or do like your stores, or like your stores but hate the smell of it, or something like that, which all of those individual metrics can then be assigned to these segments that you're building in your first party strategy, even if it's potentially anonymous. You know, you can't always go and ethically assign your records in a CRM or a CDP to somebody that's talking on social media without their consent. So it might just be thematic at some point?
I mean, it's only recently that I have been exposed to social regression analysis, which is so critical for brands to take note of. But there's two things that you mentioned. Is one is the automation of data. So, you know, we're going to remove the manual process out of the equation. And two is technology being the key enabler. I mean, when we start to talk about technology, there are so many different diverse technology out there to do the job. What are some of the ways brands, you know, what do they need to take note of in terms of choosing the right tech stack for this?
Yeah, it's an increasingly complicated process, we find. And what we've been doing with a lot of our customers is going through a bit of an audit process where we look at things like, what are the technologies that already exist in the company? What are the processes that exist? What kind of data already exists? What has to stay? What doesn't have to stay? And then working out what all the different divisions potentially need, or stakeholders potentially need, or what the customer needs at the end of the day, because maybe those needs of the stakeholders can change. And then starting by building a scope and a requirements list of what's required. And then only after that point do you start investigating and shortlisting the kinds of technologies that fill those gaps. Because that is, you know, despite the fact that, yes, it's complicated and there's so much to choose from, the benefit of having that is there's definitely going to be a technology solution, whether it's one solution or a combination of platforms that answers that requirement perfectly. And it's really just about, do you have the time and the resources to actually go through that process first before, you know, going down the road of potentially sitting in sales calls and listening to what various vendors have to say? Because it all sounds the same after a while. You know, when you sit in 10, 15 different pitches, it all starts blurring into one and it's hard to differentiate. So we strongly suggest going through that audit and scoping process first before evaluating too much technology. But again, the benefit is there will be something that fits it perfectly. And once you've made that choice, the cost savings after the fact are highly tangible. So we would definitely suggest take it slow, but don't waste time. Like we said, we're a little bit behind the rest of the world.
Calvin, to be honest with you, nearly every single day, and this is no joke, I've been called or emailed or on LinkedIn by different service providers selling something new and also saying that their tech is, or their tool is, the best in the industry. So it's very difficult, because if you start to look at this MarTech landscape, it just keeps on growing and expanding. And one of the things, and this is, you know, for South African brands, realistically, not all brands have the type of investment or budgets to actually invest in some of these technology. You know, so where do we draw the line, for example, a small and medium business versus a large corporate, in saying what you should be considering? Because I don't see anything out there in the market. I'm not sure if you are exposed to anything.
There are definitely solutions for every level. What I think where the complexity comes in is when you look at a spreadsheet of checkboxes. So, I mean, think of the RFP process. Most vendors will say that they can do what is required, but there are levels. You know, there are enterprise versions, and then there are mid-level versions, and there's entry-level versions of the same kinds of technology. And I think it just does take a little bit of objectivity, I guess, to evaluate, first of all, where does your company sit? And every company believes that they need the best, but like you say, budgets don't always exist. And part of that process is maybe to start with what is the budget. I guess a bit of a inside scoop, because we are, my company does technology sales as part of its business. We know that brands are very hesitant to disclose their budget because they think the vendor is going to push up their price to whatever that budget is.
But is that not true, though?
No, well, okay. It depends on the vendor.
It depends on the vendor. Yes, not everybody is the same.
But essentially, there's value in coming out the gates and saying, guys, this is what our budget is. Let's be realistic about what we can possibly get for this. What can't we get? And should we even continue speaking? Because we went through a process like this with one of our clients recently, where we helped them choose some technology. And by starting with the budget that's comfortable, you know, we knew that there was going to be some variance up or down. But by understanding what was comfortable, we were able to exclude 80% of the solutions out there, and not necessarily have to try and force fit our needs within their technologies. And you know, even the enterprise guys might come in and say that yes, we could do it for X amount, but realistically, you'd probably be losing some of that functionality that was inspiring in the first place. So I think there's a bit of honesty. Soul searching from the brand to decide that once, you know, there is a comfortable budget, and we have to understand that maybe that's not the top technology in the world with the top services required, but potentially we can get away with 60% of what's available and fits within the budget, but maybe lower expectations.
Yes, so but where does that mandate sit within an organization? Is it the CIO office? Is it marketing? Is it CTO? Because very often there is that siloed view of how these decisions are taken. And then sometimes after the fact, the decision's been made and the rest of the organizations need to retrofit into that solution, which might not be the actual solution that's required, you know, to get the job done. So I'm often finding that too, it's that fragmentation within organizations. Okay, maybe let's just tackle that, because I have another question for you.
Sure. So it varies. Over the years, I think we've seen it. You know, there's been a strong push from CMOs to make a lot of those choices, and then IT and CTOs got upset because there was almost this shadow IT that was being built outside of their control. I think with the addition of things like a CIO coming into organizations, that is moving. We're seeing a lot of that decision making moving to that space, but because there's always going to be varying incentives to different parts of the company, it's almost valuable to try and find some kind of a completely objective, almost an outside view, or lack of a better word, consultants to come in and assist with that. And I'm not talking, you know, necessarily you don't need these massive consulting firms that will take, personal story. I just remember when I was at Celsi, we had consultants come in and everybody, you know, had to wait for 2 years before any decisions were made. But, having some kind of an outsider view helps, because there's no incentive apart from giving the answer to making that happen. And I remember having this discussion with Simon Camara, who's now MultiChoice, when we were working together, was coming up with this idea of having almost like a think tank of people who are completely unincentivized. This was more in the marketing space of creative and agency space, of having this think tank of heads of agencies sitting around, and none of those agency heads were allowed to actually have a horse in the race, and hopefully through that come up with better ideas. So I think there's a similar idea with technology as well, almost having like a an external technology advisor that has no horse in the race. It helps.
Mm, because I would say it needs to be a human-centered technology, you know, not just a functional one. But so I think supporting what you've just said, what's important is brands having the right skills, expertise, and capability sitting with the team, because even the best investment in technology will lead you, you know, you'll gain no value from it. And that's also something that's lacking in South Africa. Very few people have the technical knowledge, because it's almost about educating, changing the culture, adoption of this technology to make it more practical in terms of everyday usage. Because very often people, you know, wait for your external partners to give you things. And what it allows you to do is just empower yourself with the right data to make the right decisions.
I totally agree. I think one of the biggest recommendations or steps that I like to encourage is having the internal teams empowered enough to talk the talk, even if they don't necessarily have the time to have to work on all these technologies on a day-to-day basis, but maybe they're doing other jobs. They should be experts, because they should be able to, in a sentence, brief the teams that are working on these platforms, understand the capabilities and understand the possibilities as well. Because if you understand what's possible, your imagination can just go wild, and you can actually take advantage of that. One of the things that unfortunately we see a lot of is there's a lot of this feeling that technology will save the day, and once you buy it, it will, you know, once you build it, they will come. And that's not necessarily the case. Technology is an enabler for good process and strategy. And once you've got that right, you put the right technology in place to scale. And I think without understanding the mechanisms that work and the abilities that these platforms give, sometimes those strategies don't get thought of in the first place. So we'd very much like to see where the actual brand teams themselves are experts, but depending on what the organization is like, they don't necessarily need to do all the work, I suppose, but they definitely need to guide it.
So yeah, I think to almost we've coming to a close, but what I think what the key thing for me is, you know, why are we doing all of this? What does it matter at the end? And for me, it's all about growth. How do we actually use the data effectively to commercialize our efforts? It's talking about ROI or return on marketing investment at the end of the day. And then it's also having that deeper, more meaningful relationships with customers, enhancing the user experience, driving quality output. So how can brands start linking once they get this right? Obviously, you mentioned through our conversation, it's a journey. It's looking at your data maturity levels. At which stage are you at within your brand, and what steps you need to take to climb up that maturity ladder? How do you link it back to growth and commercial value? Because I'm finding that when you want to invest in technology, you need to build a business case, you know, you need to show your MPV. So what can brands do in this case?
I think there's going to be a portion of time where we need to refocus our energies less on acquisition and more on retention and growth of our existing base. So, I mean, I suppose it's a bit of a biased view because of what we're talking about, but if we're talking about putting effort into this first party data strategy, that is essentially where the benefits lie. It's not going to be massive new business acquisition growth if you do this first party data strategy well. It will improve because you're obviously gathering more insights as to what works. So the better clients, the better you know your clients, the better you'll be able to find new clients. But where the most value for companies are going to be in the next 1 to 3 years, I think, is putting more value into that customer retention value. You know, what is the value of keeping this customer? What's that lifetime value? And then improving on efficiencies in terms of how that is serviced. So the costs of potentially not duplicating efforts across different divisions, against not maybe targeting people that don't need to see that message, because they're already customers, or they're certain customers, or something along those lines. And then also to increase their spend with you as a brand, you know, because you know them better and you are able to assist them with things that they actually need. So that's my view on this particular strategy and where the value comes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that with this new era of data revolution also comes next level of measurement. So we're looking at a range of measures and moving from traditional vanity metrics into more holistic end-to-end measurement becomes critical for all businesses, because it's about transparency, democratization of data, you know, that value exchange with your consumer, that all parties involved in this ecosystem starts benefiting, you know, and feeding off each other at the end of the day.
Absolutely. It's I think it's been, it's one of those things that we've always dreamed of. And, you know, I know the term single view of customer, or even single voice of customer, has been bandied about for forever. And even now, when I speak to some people, they're like, oh, it's a dream. It's not possible. But it actually is, you know, to some extent. So it's really just around what does that mean? What does that term actually mean for individual companies? Because not every company is going to be the same. And then, you know, prioritizing that. So very exciting times, I think.
Definitely. So, Calvin, in closing, what are the three things would you would like to leave our listeners with in terms of having a single view of customers, and how should they be navigating through this data revolution?
So I think, you know, the three steps that are used in this journey a lot are, number one, collection. Is how, are we putting a priority on where we're collecting our data? Is it good data? Is it solid data? Secondly, are we unifying and enriching that? So are we, you know, cognizant of the fact that all of this data could potentially be unified as a single profile for individuals and then for segments, etc.? And then the third one is actually taking action on that. Is fine, we've got it. And I mean, everyone's had this big data project going for 5 years, you know, since whenever they started it. But are we able to take immediate action, and intelligent action on the stuff that we have and the changing stuff that we have? So collect, unify, take action. I guess those are the key pillars to a strong single view of customer strategy.
You also mentioned that your company, you know, does consultations and technology solutions. How would someone get hold of you if they needed further assistance?
They are more than welcome to reach out to me personally on LinkedIn. They're welcome to go to our website at uno.co.za. Everyone always gets that wrong. It's not a U, it's a Y-O-U.
Yeah, me too.
So you know that's here today, but they can also email me. I'm sure that we can, it's calvin@uno.co.za. So more than happy to help, but I've got a feeling that everybody's connected in the smaller industry of ours, so we'll get to chat at some point if they want to.
Absolutely. Calvin, thank you so much for your time. I think this was an awesome conversation.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
We're excited. You're excited.
I really value and appreciate your support during this time.
Helping decision makers navigate the change and keep some change in their pockets.
Don't forget to subscribe, follow our Instagram handle at
TalkDigitalZA.
Engage us on our website at TalkDigitalZA.co.za.
And who knows, you could be featuring on the next one.